Cet épisode est rendu possible grâce au soutien de Squarespace. Squarespace est la plateforme tout en un pour permettre aux entrepreneurs de se démarquer et réussir en ligne, et ce, quelle que soit la taille de leur activité. Pourquoi est-ce que j'ai choisi Squarespace comme sponsor du podcast? D'abord parce que je sais qu'ici vous êtes très nombreux à entreprendre, avoir un podcast ou un projet qui nécessite d'être valorisé sur un site web. Et que Squarespace propose des outils vraiment simples d'utilisation pour avoir un site beau, propre et efficace en un minimum de temps. Quelques exemples de fonctionnalités, des templates de sites web personnalisables et adaptatifs pour créer des sites beaux et design en un temps record. L'outil email, le nerf de la guerre pour développer votre activité et communiquer avec vos clients. Ou encore leur outil SEO intégré pour émerger sur Google sans être un produit métier. Alors si vous voulez donner à votre business toutes les chances de se développer, je ne peux que vous recommander d'aller sur le site squarespace.com. En plus, Squarespace vous offre moins 10% sur votre première commande de site web ou de domaine avec le code Pauline. N'hésitez pas et rendez-vous sur squarespace.com, code Pauline. Hello everyone, here is Pauline Legnaud and I'm very happy to be with you for this new episode in English with Kinjal Mathur, who is CMO of Squarespace. And first and foremost, I just wanted to say that this is not a sponsored episode. I have been doing some pre-roll with Squarespace, which is a company that I really enjoy and think is very useful for young entrepreneurs. However, this is absolutely not a sponsored episode. I was just passionate about Kinjal's story. And so, who is Kinjal Mathur? She is an American CMO of Squarespace currently, who is really passionate about fashion, business, and tech, and is also of Indian origin. We've spoke about her passion about the fashion industry and her story in this regard, but also of being a woman of Indian origin in a sector where this is not something very common. And actually what I thought very interesting is that Kinjal was for a long time not aware of her difference as an Indian origin woman in the tech industry. And so we talked a lot about diversity, women leadership, and what to do basically in this regard. We also talked about Kinjal's other passion, which is helping basically entrepreneurs to develop their brands. And so she gave a lot of very valuable advice on how to, build awareness for your brand. Because of course, as CMO of Squarespace, this is something she really, really delve into. And also she's a board member in a lot of tech companies. Well, with no further ado, I hope you will enjoy this episode and my conversation with Kinjal Mathur. Hello, Kinjal.
Hi.
I'm very excited to be talking to you today.
I am very, very thrilled to be here today
with
you.
And I know that you had to go through rain, walking for hours to come to me. So
poor me, walking through the streets of Paris.
I know, it's so difficult.
It was a beautiful walk over and you have a lovely office. So thank you for having me.
Well, I'm quite excited because we have a lot of ground to cover. Mm-hmm. I thought about how I would start this interview. And actually, because I'm sure a lot of French people listening to the podcast, don't know you, I think the best way would be to start, by going all the way back.
Okay.
To little Kinjal. How was little Kinjal? Where did she grow? What was her background like? I would love to know more about, you a few years back.
Yeah, sure. Well, little Kinjal is more than a few years back. But
it doesn't look like it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I was born and raised in Texas, in the United States. First generation born immigrants. My parents both came over from India via Africa and then over to Texas. It was a very modest upbringing. I was kind of between two cultures. My parents were trying very hard to assimilate into American culture, but we spent our weekends doing all things Indian culture related. And so I grew up with this sense of trying to figure out how to belong. And that's kind of been a thread that I've had that's carried me through my adulthood. Something that I think about when raising my own children. But the experience has definitely kind of shaped my value system. But modest upbringing, you know, we had tennis courts on every corner. It was sunny all the time. Education was free and lovely, and parents were both caring and nurturing, and I had an older brother that kept me honest, so it was a really nice upbringing.
An older brother that kept you honest. Mm-hmm. That's, I can't let this pass. What does this mean exactly?
You know, I think brothers have this really good ability to never let you get too full of yourself. Mm. And so every time I tried to keep up with him or even surpass him in anything athletic or academic, he was right there to show me that he could either do it better or that I wasn't doing it quite as well as I thought. So they keep you grounded. But he's 3 years older. He's consistently been a figure in my life that I've looked up to. But also, he's just this naturally incredibly smart human. And I've had to work hard for everything I've ever achieved. And he just gets it very naturally. And so he's kind of always been my like pillar of goal setting.
Hmm. You were mentioning your bicultural background. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is very interesting for us in France, because France is a very old school country, I must say, in a sense that we have, of course, immigration, but I would say that it's not as fully intertwined into the population as it is in the US, well, where there's really have had, naturally, because of the history of the country, much more immigration. And so what's interesting is that I think in the US, there's a much more... the communities form in a much more powerful way, I would say. And what was very interesting to what you would say was that you really were between two cultures. And so you both had the Indian cultures and the American cultures. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people in France would love to know what your struggles or what the advantages of such a bicultural way of being was for you.
Yeah, I'll start with the advantages. I think you just naturally, when you're getting exposed to a multicultural kind of existence, you naturally start to come at life with a global perspective. Like this idea of being a global citizen is just rooted in who you are. And so I always knew the world around me was so much bigger than where I was physically in that moment. Mm. And I think that's really powerful when you're a kid, because you dream bigger, you think bigger. Mm. I knew that Texas wasn't going to be my end-all be-all. And that really came from a global mindset. And so that's a really big advantage. I think the disadvantage is kind of what I alluded to in the value system that is created from being multicultural, is that you are always kind of wondering, how do you truly belong? Like, do you belong in any one culture? Are you different? You know, is anyone dealing with the same like identity questions you're dealing with? And so finding community and being able to kind of work through that and really hone your sense of belonging is something that I think you can either do very intentionally, or it's a byproduct, but it's hard and it's tough. And I found that when I was my American self, I was always like, well, not everybody here understands what, you know, I'm doing, thinking, feeling, because they don't know my Indian self. And then when I was with my Indian friends and in my Indian culture, I'm like, wait, but I don't want to like fully lean in because I have this other part of me. And so that idea of being multifaceted is a beautiful thing, but can it also weigh on you as you're like moving through life and making decisions and finding your community.
And so how did you, I mean, I don't know if you have, but how did you come to terms with this mix and match? And would you have any pieces of advice for people, maybe younger people listening to us today
who go through
these phases?
The thing that I found the most enlightening, as I've now gotten older and can say it with perspective, is I truly believe that I had moved from trying to assimilate into a community and find my community to just letting my community find me. Like being who I am, talking openly about the struggles of having one foot in, one foot out, what it is to be from a place like Texas, which is a very different place in the United States. And I'm in New York now, and they couldn't be more opposite. There's a lot of things that have shaped my identity over time. But I think the one thing I would say about this when it comes to a sense of belonging is be who you're going to be, openly talk about it, be, you know, very secure in that, and let your community find you. And you'll be very surprised by how many people are dealing with the same things you're dealing with, and how you're not alone. And that took me a long time to figure out. So be authentically you.
Yeah. And I love this idea of you're not alone, which is, I'm sure, not very easy to see when you're younger and you feel that you're alone basically in your school because you're the only Indian American basically. Yep. And actually there are tons of Indian Americans and all struggling for the same reason. So
I can't tell you how funny it is. I always, you know, thought that my experience was just so different. And then I get to New York and again, I start just, you know, I start finding people and people start finding me and I start talking. And I'm like, we could have been sisters. Like, you have exactly the same upbringing and challenges. And so it is really wonderful when you have that moment that you realize you're not alone.
What were your dreams when you were a child?
Oh, goodness. My dreams were my parents' dreams. My dreams were, you know.
So you went down this road too.
Of course. You know, they wanted me to be in medicine. And I remember every time as a kid when we had to fill out the survey of like, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? I was always listing some kind of doctor. Mm-hmm. And then I finally became an adult at 18 and was like, wait, I have no desire. My brother's a doctor. And I saw him go through it. And I was like, that is not my path. That seems not interesting to me at all. I've always had like a creative streak in me too. And I'm like, I could not imagine going to like a sterile, like literally a sterile environment every day. And so that dream quickly burst. And then I was lost. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I went to college. I majored in what I knew I was good at. I had been coding since I was in high school. And I was like, I'll go into like some technical field, but not engineering because my dad was an engineer and I didn't want to take his path. So I knew what I didn't want to do, which I think is also part of the process. And I spent most of my college like time just like really exploring what I wanted to do. And I still will tell you, I don't know what I want to do in life. Like, I think that's a beautiful thing to feel that there's a world of possibility. But my younger self thought I was going to be in medicine. And then my teenage and adult self was like, that's not the path for me.
And now that you have a little more experience, what would you say drives you as a woman, as a businesswoman? I know you're very, very invested in a lot of causes for entrepreneurship. But I would love to know, like, what's basically, as a human, you would say, and a professional, your mission, really, what drives you? What makes you want to move mountains, you know?
Oh, goodness. I talk about this with my team a lot, like just what makes you pop out of bed. I think there's two things. I think the first one is I have a sense of responsibility to the people that and the generations that look like me that will come up in this world and holding the door wide open for them. Like as I moved through my career, I never identified as a woman. I never identified as a person of color. I just did what I had to do to try to find my path. And when I started engaging with the younger generation, started thinking about mentorship, and I kept getting asked the question, well, how are you a woman that like made it in tech? Like, what did that feel like for you? And I was like, wait, what? Like, I did not identify that way as I was moving through my career. And I started taking unconscious bias lessons. I really started equipping myself with the tools and the knowledge of what the world looks like with the constructs we live in and some of the doors that were probably closed off to me that I didn't even know were closed. And as I started to get more versed in that and starting to realize just how tough it really is for women and for women of color, I realized that whether I like it or not, whether I identified with it or not as I was coming up, it is now my responsibility to keep that door wide open. So that drives me in a lot of what I do. Like any investing that I do, any mentorship that I do, it's predominantly around women and women of color.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but was there a moment that you remember where you really saw for the first time, like, oh, it's actually something that I need to take into account?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was actually this moment when I was at Foursquare, which was this tech company in New York City, and I was sitting there on stage, and we did this all hands weekly, and I'm sitting there on stage, and I got to ask the question of just like, so what's been the first 90 days of being CMO? Like, how, what has it been like, and what has it been like being the only woman in the room? And I looked around and I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize that my entire exec team were all white males. Like it didn't even dawn on me. And it was that moment I felt embarrassed. I felt, negligent. I was like, it didn't even occur to me. And it was that exact moment that I was like, I need to wake up. Like I need to understand why my experience is the way that it is and what I represent for everybody looking up at me on that stage. And that's when I started on my journey of figuring out what it is to have unconscious bias, what it is to navigate through, situations that are not, when the cards aren't stacked in your favor. And so it was a real moment of realization. And so that, you know, that is one thing. I think the other thing is when I became a mother, I really, and it sounds so cheesy, and I always say this about motherhood, it's like all the cliches are right, but I actually really started caring about the planet in a real way. And I was like, oh my goodness, like my boys are going to grow up and they need to live in a world that is kind and a world that's not like totally crumbling under their feet. And so, you know, starting to find purpose in work is something that I really, you know, that started to really mean something to me, where I'm like, success now has like very much been redefined after motherhood, where success for me is that no matter what I'm doing in life or what anybody in my, you know, in my world is doing in life, that they're finding purpose to leave the world in a better place than when they found it. And so now, you know, I say at Squarespace that, you know, marketing's role is to build a soul for the brand. And one of the missions that I have and that, you know, I push on the team and that I hope more people in marketing adopt is trying to drive business through social impact. And, you know, everything's about in marketing, just like what's the return on an ad spend? You know, how do you grow a business? And those are really clear metrics and making a direct business impact matters. But when you're putting dollars into the world, you have the ability to shape a conversation and you can make social impact with it too. And so how do you find the balance of those two things and find purpose in the work, even if you're working in a capitalistic, you know, company, is something that I'm extremely passionate about redefining kind of the role of what it means to have business impact through social impact.
So it's interesting because there's a lot of debate about the fact that having a social impact is incompatible basically with capitalism or return on investment, as you were saying, but I believe it's not the case. Yeah. And I'm sure you believe it's not the case. Maybe I'm wrong, but I would love to hear your point of view on this. And more interestingly, do you have examples maybe of how social impact actually had also economical impact?
Yeah. So, so I have heard that a lot too. And I think if you fundamentally come from a place of adopting a mindset that is any small change matters, And I think people get caught up in that. Like, I think people say, like, unless I'm making massive changes in the world around me, what's the point of doing it? So I think it first starts from a, like, you have to believe and adopt that any change, no matter how small or big, matters. Mm-hmm. So if you start from that mindset, where I come from, like, even, you know, in the role that I play is like, every partnership we're doing, every campaign we put out there, every customer story we're telling, how do we add a little bit of impact into it, right? And so I'll give you an example. We were the sponsors, the jersey sponsors for the New York Knicks for 5 years, their first 5 years. And wonderful, the MSG organization is a wonderful organization. Our team specifically was really great to work with. But I said, look, we are doing this because, you know, we want to build our brand awareness and we want to own our city, which is New York City. And there's no better way to do it than being involved in a sports team and having your patch right on their heart. And so we're going to do that. And that is the goal, the fundamental goals of this campaign. Mm. But let's be honest, we're spending a lot of money to do this, MSG. And so what I worked into the deal terms was they had to take a portion of the spend that we were giving them and put it into what we call the Make It Fund. So we coined this term and we said, this is reserved for two things. It is reserved for serving underrepresented communities in the business world. And it is for helping people, entrepreneurs, get started. Mm. Those fundamentally, those two things. So the first one we said, okay, and we knew that we had runway. I said, look, we can't solve this in 1 year. And I understand that. So what, again, back to the small change, like what can we do incrementally every year for the next 5 years that we're in this relationship together? And so we started doing initiatives with this money that we had set aside that MSG contractually had to execute for us to do community building things that serve these two purposes. And we did really interesting things like start a Make It Fund where we had all these businesses around, we did a call to action. We used our media during halftime. We used MSG's TV media to talk about applying for this business loan that we were going to give for three people that had the best business idea that also were creating a business that impacted their community. And so they had to have that thread in their business plan. And we did that every year for 5 years. They would get a grant. They would get media space that we would give from our MSG deal. And they would get awarded on the biggest stage, which is Madison Square Garden at halftime. They would get awarded Incredible. A check and they would get all of that media value. And so we did that every year. So there were just things like that that we worked in. But like really what was interesting is we were like, okay, that's good and well, but how do we get a long-term impact out of what we're doing? And so we did this thing where we partnered with the New York City Small Business Association, where they are charged with helping small businesses around New York City get loans. The problems with giving loans to underserved communities is the risk profile, the risk rating is really high. Yeah. And so normally banks do not give funding at the local level, or it comes with terms that are just unreasonable. Mm-hmm. So most female entrepreneurs of color that are starting small businesses in these communities are putting it on their credit card. Mm. And the truth is they're not even carrying it. They're paying off that credit card every month. And so the risk profile is actually much lower, but the banks haven't caught up with that. Mm. So we worked with Goldman Sachs to underwrite an entire fund where we said we want to go to local branches in certain boroughs and have them give loans at better terms and we will underwrite the risk. That's where the dollars are going to go to. And so we were able to get more money in the hands of female entrepreneurs that did not have access to capital through their local banks by underwriting the risk. Mm. And so that has long-term economic value. Again, like, are we shaping in the entire New York York City, you know, economy through this. No, but it's like the belief as a marketer that you can do the business impact and meet all the things we wanted to do with MSG, but we could stack hands together as two powerful brands in New York and say, let's like bite off a chunk of this. Let's like just commit to saying we can do something, something. And I'm really proud of the work that we did. It was really awesome. So I just think that's like my, you know, that's a really, you know, specific example, but my goal in sharing that is to say, if you just come through the lens of anything that you're doing, any marketing that you're doing, any brand partnership that you're doing, and you think about how can we just like make a little bit of a difference and get creative in our thinking here, you'd be surprised how much like, you know, added value you can come up with that can have lasting impact.
Very, very interesting. And I thank you for sharing it, because I think a lot of people put the problem in the opposite way. What I mean by that is that basically they only think of the social impact, and so try and strive to only have social impact. Whereas what's very interesting what you were saying is that basically there is like a business impact first and foremost, but where you add on through this.
Yep.
I mean, very important in your case, very important partnership, like a lot of value, but it's basically on top of it. So that's very interesting in terms of mindset, I believe. Yeah. I also wanted to talk about your investment as an investor and as a mentor to help entrepreneurs, and what I understand, mostly female entrepreneurs of color. How did that come about? How did you start investing? How did you start being a mentor?
Yeah. Well, one, I have a wonderful network of friends that are all doing interesting and creative things. So I'm constantly getting inspired by just the rise of entrepreneurship, but just the passion that comes with that economy. And the really interesting thing is the dynamic that's happening in venture capitalism is they are worried about deal flow. They are worried about getting access to entrepreneurs, because most entrepreneurs now are raising through their networks. They are saying like, I'm going to do a friends and family round and I'm not going to take institutional dollars. I think there's been this negative kind of correlation of if you take institutional dollars, then you're going to be held to a different standard as a startup and have to have different, you know, outcomes. And like most people don't want the pressure of that. And because of that negative correlation, a lot of VCs have introduced what they call scout funds. And so I've been working with a VC out in California for the last 5 years, and I'm a scout for them, where basically I, because I have this network of wonderful women doing wonderful things, they give me an allowance to go and invest in all of these businesses that I find. And so I still use my business knowledge to, you know, to look at the deal and make sure that it feels like a company that I believe in, and then I get to write a check from them. And it comes from me. It's no strings attached. The VC just wants to be able to be there if they ever go to Series A or B and they need additional capital. And so it solves their problem of being able to have deal flow and access to all these founders doing amazing things. And it solves my desire to fund people doing like really, really awesome work. And that happens to be my community of women and women of color. So it's been this like real blessing in disguise, but I kind of came into it because, again, through a South Asian woman that worked at this VC, she tapped me to say, you know, people doing good things, like, here's some money, like, go fund it.
And so what are the main criterias, would I say, for you to invest? Like, what basically turns you on? Yeah. When do you really say like, oh my God, this is something I want to put my money in?
I'm a consumer girl by heart. That's my experience. I am a marketer that can only market if I can feel the pain of the consumer and the problem we're trying to solve. So I invest in the consumer space mainly. And what gets me excited is people that are building products and services that are filling a gap in a really creative way. So like inclusive beauty, making beauty products for dark skin, like what a gap, let's go after it. Or people that are doing a business model in a different way. And so they're coming at it from a different way. So I invest in entrepreneurs that do product development by crowdsourcing, by saying like, I have this community of people, they really care about their hair. I'm going to figure out what their biggest hair concerns are, and I'm going to do product development accordingly. And from a consumer standpoint, and somebody that believes in customer centricity, like what better way to create products than to talk to your community and create it for them? And then you have a built-in buyer base. And so it's consumer first. It's I got to feel the passion from the founder that they have felt the problem acutely and they know what they're trying to solve. And that I see that they are either have a flip on a business model or they're serving like a real identifiable gap. Those are the things that I get really excited about Monday.
I'd love to segue and talk about small businesses and how to help small businesses, because so this has been also one of your missions, as you were saying, with Squarespace notably. There's a lot of people listening to this podcast that either are freelancers or owners and basically entrepreneurs of small businesses, I would say between 5 and 20, maybe 30 employees. And I would say that one of the main things that they really struggle with is naturally sales and awareness, how to build awareness, and a lot so when it's in a consumer goods industry. I'm sure this is something you've talked about a lot, but I would love to have your pieces of advice on these people. And of course, I know, let's put a lot of, you know, caveats that you are going to give advice, but advice for one person may not work for another one. So it's only, of course, something that you're going to say as a personal piece of advice. But I think it will help a lot of people that are struggling, because sometimes also they're more like technicians. They're passionate about their art, you know, but they're not very good at marketing. And so I'm in front of like literally the guru of marketing for small businesses. So I would love to have your piece of advice on this.
Oh man, I don't think I deserve that title, but I'll take it in this moment. You know, I think the biggest piece of advice I have, and I definitely do talk to a lot of entrepreneurs about this. We pick this up in all of our studies of small businesses when at Squarespace, but the thing you own that's completely free and completely yours is your story. And it kind of goes back to when you asked me, like, how do you pick the people that you're going to invest in? And I'm like, well, they need to know like the problem that they're trying to solve and why they're like acutely feel like they can solve it better than anyone else. Like that is marketing. Marketing is understanding your consumer and making sure that you're creating dialogue with them to inspire and motivate them to like buy your product, buy your service. And so what I always say to everyone is, you know, the best thing you could do about marketing is make sure that you're using every touch point that you have with the consumer to tell your story. And that's absolutely free, right? Like you don't have to have a big budget to do this. Like if you're selling a product and you're shipping things physically out to people, make sure you're telling your story about your product, why you did it, in the package itself. It's not that expensive and it goes a long way. It creates that emotional connection with somebody around why they're buying your product, right? Or if you're doing social and you're, you know, really struggling with what you should and shouldn't be talking about on social and you're running low on content, it's like, well, come back to your story of why you're doing this and make sure you're consistently telling people, to where your audience then starts to associate, you and your problem and your company with that product, where they're like, oh, they're trying to revolutionize, you know, the beauty industry with inclusive beauty. And they become the storyteller for you. Like that's how much your story has to penetrate through. And so, that would be my first piece of advice, is just like, ensure that you're optimizing every single touch point, from packaging to the follow-up email after somebody places an order, to your website and your presence that you have online, to what you're doing in social with content. Like, just make sure everything consistently is telling your story, to where you're making that connection with that consumer. And that's absolutely free. Nobody owns your story the way that you do.
Yeah. Great piece of advice.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Oh,
I'm pushing you.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. So if I'm thinking 5 to 20 people and the size of the company, that would be
I was just going to add, to give you more context, that I also believe a lot of people listening to the podcast, and what I see in general on my social media, is that they also fear technical issues, would I say, and they basically feel that they're sort of imposters on like 80% of their business, and that they know their product, they're product builders, but for the rest, basically, they don't feel very comfortable. And so maybe there's also something to help them with on that regard.
Yeah, I mean, imposter syndrome, that is, it's just like a whole, that's a whole other podcast, but, you know, I think two things. I think one, we live in a fantastic era where there's a lot of do-it-yourself tools. And so, you know, this is my plug for Squarespace, is that you don't have to be an expert in everything. That's what, there's software and there's tools that are solving that for entrepreneurs, right? Like Squarespace, you can have a website that looks like a professional created and designed it, and you can have it up in an hour. And you can start doing email marketing pretty seamlessly with a few clicks. Like, you can start creating courses and gated content and having passive revenue through an hour of setting that up on your website.
Which is unbelievable.
Which is unbelievable. Like, the do-it-yourself tools that exist now to fill the gaps of what you needed to either have a sick tech team, or you would need to know it yourself, are amazing.
And it, when you think about it, like 5 years ago, or even like 10 years ago, it was completely impossible.
No, I mean 20 years ago, when .com was really taking off, and .com retail, and when I was on the retail side of it, like, you know, people were paying us hundreds of thousands of dollars to help them create their online presence. And now for $20 a month, you can, you know, you could get it up and running. And so, one, I think we live in a fantastic era that if you have a gap, then there is a tool out there to help you solve it and help you feel very professional in doing it. And that's a really wonderful thing. I think the second thing I would say that I think that is one of the biggest, failures of entrepreneurs is not asking for the help. Like, if you are waking up every morning with something keeping you up at night, and you feel that you don't know how to work through it, ask for the help. Make sure that you're creating network and community of your own where you can actually go and ask for help. And I think that is a lost art in some ways with entrepreneurs, of just finding a founder community. We try to do it a lot at Squarespace, where we try to bring the community together. Like, even here, I'm here in Paris. Tomorrow we're hosting, you know, a brunch where we're bringing entrepreneurs together to talk to each other and build company community. And if I leave and the only thing I've ever done is connect two people together that can then start to help one another, like, I consider this a massive success of a trip. You know, it's something that I think gets overlooked because time is of essence, but like, build a community where you can ask for help. And so you're not waking up every morning in a cold sweat wondering how you're going to solve that problem, because you're, again, you're not alone. That's the theme of that podcast. It's you're not alone at any stage of life.
Very true. Very true. And what's funny is that I was reflecting on my own journey, and I'm myself, you know, the owner now of a company of like 80 people, and even
super successful company.
Thank you very much. But even at that level, I know that I have this bias of not asking.
Yeah.
And that I'm still often like doing my stuff on my own and thinking like, oh, how am I going to do this? And it's sometimes so easy when you think about it to actually ask and have someone for whom what you're struggling with is just a piece of cake.
Yeah.
And this is not always very expensive also.
I agree. I do this thing on Instagram where I put out a question, how can I help? And I do it like once a quarter. And some of the questions are as easy as like, I'm trying to get my you know, advertising, like, spend to scale? Like, what's the one metric I should be thinking of? And it's like, for me, it takes 10 seconds to answer that question on a direct message. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so I think the best you can do is ask for help. And the best you can do is help.
Of course.
And so it's just, it's a beautiful thing when you build that network and you build a community that you can like quickly throw that out there and get the answers and feel confident that you can get in front of some good advice. Mm.
Going back on the more corporate side, there's also a lot of people listening to this podcast who are working in companies, not as founders. And a lot of women mainly, I think, will be very sensible to what you were saying, sensitive to what you were saying, because basically feel the infamous imposter syndrome, always basically taming down their ambition, I feel, because probably they're scared of looking too aggressive or are not educated in that way. Is it something that you also see in your company or in the US? And and how basically do you try to help them? Because this is something that I really feel. I've been going through a lot of interviews right now in my company and trying to hire a lot of people. And it's crazy how it's different when you interview a man and a woman. Honestly, it's just insane.
I know.
So
I know. It's crazy. Of course it's happening in America. Of course it's happening. Like, and there's no company, there's no industry I've ever been when it's where it's not happening. And all the piece of advice that I would say is like, even the terms of in your mind when you're like, oh, I'm gonna come off too aggressive, or like, I'm going to come off too loud or too sharp tongue. These are all adjectives that we need to stop associating with ourselves. Like, we need to start telling ourselves it is okay. It's not aggressive. It's advocation. You know, I need to, it's not ambition. I just deserve the space. I need to take up more space. And, you know, I think that, the place that I've come to with all of this is, and it comes from a place of feeling at peace with it, but it's, I'm gonna be who I want to be, and I'm gonna advocate for myself. And if somebody finds me too aggressive, too loud, too obnoxious, too ambitious, they're not my people. And you have to kind of move through, I think, the corporate world with that attitude of, I'm going to be the best version of myself and unapologetically me. And if the company I'm with or the people that I'm around don't appreciate it, well, then they're not my people. That's not where I should be waking up and dedicating my time, which is my biggest asset in life. I'm not going to give it to people that don't value it the same way I value it. And so, you know, be who you're going to be and your community will find you. I'm a firm believer in that. And be in a company that is going to value you for taking up the space and allowing you to blossom. And it's a, you know, employership is at will. And so if you give it 110%, you know, the company should want to match you with that, you know, hour for hour. So be who you're going to be ambitious, take up space, be unapologetically you.
Have you ever yourself felt these emotions?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. And I tell myself what I just said right now, I say it in my head. yeah, I think it's, I think it's natural. And I know that it's like a very, you know, the conversation is starting to shift, at least like in New York, where, you know, people are saying like women shouldn't even talk about imposter syndrome. Like that shouldn't even be a thing that we're okay with feeling. And a real shift in wanting to even say that we have it. But I think it's very natural to feel uncomfortable when you're pushing yourself to do big things. And I think that is the motivator to do big things, is to get comfort in the uncomfortable. And if I did not feel scared, then I would be worried that I'm not pushing myself as hard as I could. So I do think it's natural when you're taking big risk to feel uncomfortable at times and to feel scared at times. And if you don't feel the fear, then I don't know if you're doing the right things for yourself.
It's great that you're talking about fear and risk, because I also feel that sometimes women, and maybe it's just a stereotype, but because they are in a certain way more scared of risk, again, tame their ambition down and don't try to reach out and don't try to go and really try to, you know, push themselves to think big. This is something I've seen again and again, honestly, with people that I've hired or while I was hiring them, that basically they were refraining themselves and not even seeing their own biases. So it's funny, it's going all the way back to those unconscious biases you were mentioning at the beginning of the podcast. Is this something that you try to help people when you work with? Like, basically, would you have any tips in terms of coaching, management, when you see someone on your team that is literally refraining herself from seeing big? How can you help her? Because it comes also from a place of fear. So this is something that's like really palpable.
Yeah.
How can you help her to put aside this fear, or actually maybe not put it aside, but own it?
I think it's pretty simple. I think you create, as a manager, if I was in that situation, I would create the safest space, the safest place for that person to take the risk. And so I would make sure that I would say and very much vocalize, like, it's okay if this doesn't work. We're okay failing. Like, it's okay to do something and it doesn't work out. And what's the worst that we do? We live and learn and move it on. And I actually have actively found myself having to say that a lot more recently. And I don't know if that's because constriction of job market, people are a little bit more fearful than they ever were before. And we're taking less risk. But I have found that when you create a safe space and you say it's okay to fail, it's okay to try something and it not work out, it really allows people to flourish. And that's when the creative thinking comes. But you have to actively assure people that they're in a safe environment for that. And I think that's the best thing that we can do as managers, is make sure that we're encouraging the risk taking and letting people know that we're okay with failure, because we'd much rather like drive innovation than just stay in a safe space.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I also find that trying to visualize, you know, the failure and to see like what would happen literally if you fail, which sometimes, you know, seems like it's going to be a catastrophe when you imagine it. And actually, I mean, okay, we lost a little bit of money, maybe your reputation is not that good anymore, but I mean, it's something you can always, you know, walk away from, and usually in a very good way. And there's often also a blessing in disguise, you know, in those failures. So, and a lot of learnings. So I find it's also a good piece of advice.
Yeah, that's great advice.
Well, Kinjil, we're leaning towards the end of this interview, and I have, you may know, always say the same questions, a set of questions that I call my one-on-one, which are more personal questions that I would love to go through with you. The first one, so it's a great segue, is, have you had in your life a great failure, your great failure, the blessing in disguise that you could talk about because you've learned so much from it?
Oh man, I don't know that there's one major failure. I feel I fail all the time, and I'm okay with that. You know, I think this isn't a major failure, but it was definitely like a setback in my career, which is, I had worked in fashion for so long, disrupting the space to be able to move fashion online. And I'd done that for the first 10 years of my career. And when I took my leap into startup world, I did it at an art startup. And I wanted to do the same thing for art that had been done with fashion, where we were driving 10% of fashion sales were happening online and less than 1% of art was being sold online. And I was like, oh, this is prime for disruption. And so here I go to this art startup, and it doesn't work. We don't disrupt it. 10 years later, there's still no art being sold online. And it was a very short stint for me. It got bought and sold very quickly, and I disrupted nothing. And I felt like a failure in that moment. And I think the biggest learning that I took from that is two things. I think the first is, and by the way, like with, when I say it very, you know, like in a very cavalier way, we got bought and sold. Like what that means is we got acquired and I had to blanket fire my entire team and let them go. Like there were hardships in this, in us not getting the runway that we thought we were going to get by disrupting this space. So the thing that I learned with that is, you know, sometimes in the failure, you like see the opportunity. And when I look back, when I was in that experience, and I looked back at that experience, it helped me. And it goes back to kind of what I was saying when I was younger too, where when you find what you don't want to do is also, there's also value in that. And so what I found through that is I'm like, I'm not an early stage startup person. Like I am not a start something from the ground up. Like that is just, I'm a scaler. I'm a growth marketer. Like I'm a strategist in that. Like how do we take this from 10 to, you know, 100? But I'm not the 0 to 10 girl. And that moment of dealing with a rocky startup that kind of had to be, you know, sold pretty quickly, helped me realize like where I can dedicate my career and my time. And it's also why I'm on the investing side of startup land and not on the entrepreneur side of startup land. And I'm very clear with my abilities in that. And so, that was a career setback, but it also helped me get focused for my next decade of what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. Very interesting. Second question, if you could change anything in your personal or professional life, what would you do differently?
I think in my personal life, I would be way more nomadic. I just think that New York drew myself and my husband in and grounded us in a way we just never thought we were going to be. And I would love to just traverse the world living and working from different places and exposing my kids to different cultures. Mm-hmm. And if I could do anything different, I would uproot myself from New York and try to figure out how to have a more nomadic life.
Come to Paris. We're waiting for you.
I need to learn French and I could do this podcast in French then.
Well, it will be a challenge, but I will be very happy to go through with it. Perfect. So this is a tricky one, but I like it. What do you find beautiful? It can be, of course, in an aesthetic way, but it can be also in a metaphoric way.
The most beautiful thing that I've experienced was last summer. I took real time off. I took my boys. We went to Comporta. I was not working. I like actively was like, I'm not going to work on this trip. And we lived by the sun coming up and the sun setting. And what I mean by that is like, we had no construct of time. We started making decisions based on when we were hungry. What did we feel like doing today? You know, what, like, how's the weather? Do we want to go on a hike? Do we want to go swimming? We just removed the construct of time. Didn't look at my phone of like, when did, like, you know, what's next? Did not plan out the days. I didn't even look up the town that we were staying in. I was like, we'll figure it out as we go along. It was removing the construct of time from life and just moving through your day through pure intuition and emotion and doing that with my boys. It was such a beautiful time in my life. And I hope one day I can return. Maybe when I'm a nomadic person traveling around the world,
maybe I will not look your at whole time lifestyle zone. Will be.
it would be the most beautiful thing is to get rid of time.
And I'm sure also getting rid of planning also was something.
I do it as a job and I hate doing it in my personal life. So just showing up sometimes is really, really nice.
I love it. I love it. So the opposite question is, what do you resent? What do you dislike when you see it? What do you feel that is really something that is unjust?
when little kids don't appreciate their parents.
Huh.
My father passed away way earlier than I would ever have liked him to, 17 years ago. And I just was like, I loved him so much, and I just didn't spend enough time really, really sitting down with him and understanding his musings and what drove him and his childhood, and asked him all the stories, right? You're like so much a kid and a teenager and like a college kid that's like, I got the world to conquer. I'll get back to you. And I was never able to get back. And so like when I see that, I'm like, you know, you as an adult have a child, you have 18 years with them if you're lucky. And then they have to go be their own adult. Like, I just wish kids understood that relationship too and spent as much time getting to know their parents and their roots and their ancestry, because it will shape them as adults. And I wish I knew that when I was a kid.
Is it something that you've shared with your own children?
When they're old enough to understand that, yeah. I'm trying to keep them in the world of like, they don't even know what time is right now.
Okay, it's another phase. Second phase will be.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Is there a quote, a maxim, like words basically that mean a lot to you, maybe words that you repeat to yourself that you could share with us?
Let's see. There's a lot of different mantras. I think that the thing I probably find myself saying the most is that there is no time like the present. And I spent my life making excuses for why right now is not the right time. I don't need, like, I'll be ready when I'm ready. And what I realized is, you know, as much as I want to plan for the future is not written for you. And so I constantly find myself, when I feel any level of hesitation to not do something or go for something, or find the time for something, is reminding myself, like, there's no time like the present. It's, you got to live in the moment.
Now, there's absolutely no segue. This is a very non-political question, correct question, and I love it for that. Mm-hmm. Is there a belief that you have that you see is not shared at all, like in the media, in society in general, could be in the US, could be worldwide? Basically, you believe something and you see that this is something that is pretty polemical.
I would have to say the thing that probably would not go over well for the people that I surround myself, which are...
And don't worry, nobody's listening.
Yeah, no, nobody but,
yeah,
you know, millions of people that listen to your podcast. New York City is a wonderful, beautiful place to change the world. Everybody's an advocate. And I'm just tired. And I think the unpopular opinion I would have, with this being an election year, is I wish we could go back to the times where you voted who you voted for, and get out and vote. Vote who you vote for, and you don't need to talk about it. Like, I would like to remove politics from the dinner table. Like, and that's a very unpopular opinion, because all everybody talks about is having the tough conversations and making sure people, like, you know, are well-versed and, like, you know, influence the vote. And I just would like to not talk about politics and go back to the days where you vote for who you vote for, you become informed, you digest information the way you need to, and you just don't talk about it.
I love it. You know, there's a funny thing is that this podcast is, in France, one of the few podcasts where I refuse to invite any politicians, and I've had a lot of demand, but this is something I don't want to go in, exactly for the same reasons.
Yeah.
So we share this unpopular opinion.
Amazing.
Two last questions.
Yeah.
Does any subject on which you change your mind come to mind? It could be recently or not.
Yeah, no, I grew up really religious. I grew up Hindu, and I went to temple every Saturday. And I actively disassociated myself from religion when I was in college. And I said, I don't need it. It doesn't need to drive me. I don't find value in it. And I'm going back on that a bit. I read The Art of Happiness, which was a book that kind of changed my viewpoint post-college. And there's something about the Buddhist principles of way of living that really resonate with me now. And especially having kids and building value systems, I'm like, oh, I understand religion for that reason. Mm. And so I haven't fully gotten back. I don't know if I need to introduce a full-blown religion, but I think exploring Buddhism a little bit more would be something that is of interest to me, and that would be a real go back on not having a place for religion in my life.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Last question. Mm-hmm. Is there a book or a few books that you would recommend because they maybe not changed your life but had a deep impact on your own life?
Mm-hmm. I would say The Art of Happiness would be one, because there's things like, again, to mantras that you tell yourself. There's Buddhist principles in there that were so relevant. Like, you know, people talk about, I need a social cleanse. I need to get off social. I can't look at it. It's, you know, mentally exhausting for me. Like the idea of being able to ignore, you know, big swaths of media is a really hard thing, right? Unless you're living in like a hole. So the better thing to do is train your mind to be able to handle it. And a lot of, in The Art of Happiness, it teaches you about losing your comparative self and what that means and how to train your mind to do that. And I think in a world of social media, principles like that can go a long way and can help you cope. And so it's a book that I still go back to, even though it's grounded in really ancient philosophy. It becomes more and more relevant as the world around us changes, which is really kind of a phenomenal thing to experience.
Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for sharing. It was extremely interesting, and I feel now that we have to do a second round when you come and live in Paris, which would be, I hope, next year. And I can personally give you French lessons. It's not a problem.
That's the podcast. You giving me French lessons and everybody laughing at how bad my French is.
But I'm very happy we could do this. Thank you for coming all this way. Thank you for being so generous with your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye bye les amis, c'est la fin de cet épisode, mais avant de vous quitter, quelques détails en plus. D'abord, pour toutes les infos sur le podcast et cet épisode, ça se passe sur polinegno.com, vous aurez tout promis, juré. Aussi, si vous souhaitez me contacter pour me poser des questions ou me proposer de nouveaux invités, eh bien n'hésitez pas à le faire directement sur LinkedIn, Instagram ou YouTube, je vous attends. Enfin, encore mille merci de m'avoir écouté jusqu'ici, j'espère de tout cœur que ça vous a plu et je vous dis à très vite pour un nouvel épisode.